WBAI Evening News, heard daily at 6 p.m. Stay tuned for Extinction Rebellion Radio coming up. Apologies. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. And we're going to get Extinction Rebellion Radio up and running as soon as possible. Please stand by.
You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI.
Welcome to the Rebellion. This is Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI with Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney. Extinction Rebellion uses nonviolent direct action to press for action on the climate emergency. Last week, we heard a talk on Extinction Rebellion's strategy from Alan McGonigal. It was an explanation of why XR makes the choices it makes. This week is the Q&A / discussion that followed from that talk. Although you can understand what we say without hearing last week's episode, it's the best experience if you hear last week's first. And once again, this is not setting out any mandatory beliefs for Extinction Rebellion activists, quite the contrary. It's trying to give some shape to the strategy that has evolved, which is not to say you must believe what we say to do climate activism with us. We are not the type of organization with a doctrine. But we do have some ideas about how to go about getting action on the climate crisis. And what we're talking through today is why those of us speaking here believe that it stands some chance of success. So, here goes.
So I want to get to your issue about the Overton window. And you said that to shift the Overton window, you cannot compromise. You have to change the narrative. And I wonder if you might speak specifically to what the narrative is that needs to be changed. What is that narrative?
Yeah, that's a great question. For me, it's about the framing of what does climate action mean in politics. And what climate action means in politics in the current Overton window, in the current narrative, is let's pick a date that feels comfortable, a date that does not feel like it's going to push us too much, a date that doesn't even necessarily require us to take immediate action. And we'll then make a roadmap justified by models that says that this roadmap could happen. And I've seen many of these models that say, you know, electric vehicle adoption will just start to change in the next 5 or 10 years. Maybe that'll happen. I mean, it hasn't happened in the last 25, but you can certainly build a model to show that's happening. So the current framing is let's pick a comfortable date, 2050, and see what happens. Maybe we'll change that date in the future. Maybe we'll start talking about 2060 as we get closer to 2050. Mm-hmm. The framing that we need to change is, what are you doing today? What are you doing this year? What are you funding? What are you putting a ban on? You need to be banning new fossil fuel construction. So we need to be demanding immediate concrete action. And that is just not even part of the narrative right now for climate change.
I think that's correct. One of the things that I get concerned about when I speak to other activists is when I say, okay, what do we need to do specifically? So that the story becomes not simply that we need to do more now, but we need to do one, this, two, another thing, we need to do this, three. So in other words, people need to become literate in what they offer as what needs to be done. So, you know, so we need climate action now is very important, a narrative to have, but then how do we get, then proceed to tell a story of exactly what needs to happen right now at this time by 2030?
Right. And one thing that I personally like to talk about for that, what needs to happen right now is actual concrete ends of specific sources of fossil fuel. And you can think about this in terms of the life of the equipment or the infrastructure you're talking about. So right now we should have a ban active on all new fossil fuel infrastructure. Every single piece of large fossil fuel infrastructure is planned to last over 30 years. Its lifetime is over 30 years. That ban should be passed today, unless they're planning on early retiring these large new fossil fuel plants that they're installing. You can talk about home boiler systems or gas systems that heat your house. That should be banned in the next 5 years. They have a 25-year lifespan if you're serious about a 2050 timeframe. So people talk about 2050. They don't say in 5 years, we are banning new boiler systems on natural gas. You know, cars last 10 to 15 years. So that means 2035, no new fossil fuel vehicles can be sold after the year 2035. Every automobile manufacturer in the United States should start to plan towards that. Mm-hmm. So you could go industry by industry and set the concrete transition timelines. but rather than doing that, the government wants to keep it at the high level of 2050, and we'll see where it goes.
Right. Earlier in the talk, you talk about individual actions and how they don't really sort of add up to the kind of large scale solutions that we need. And I totally agree with that. But there was a report just recently released by the World Inequality Lab, and it makes me think that maybe XR needs to sort of update its critique around the individual actors. And what that report said is that addressing large inequalities in carbon emissions is essential for tackling climate change. And they go on to say that global income and wealth inequalities are tightly connected to ecological inequalities and to inequalities in contributions to climate change. Our novel data set on carbon emissions inequalities reveals important inequalities in CO2 emissions at the world level. The top 10% of emitters are responsible for close to 50% of all emissions, while the bottom 50% produce 12% of the total. So there are individuals who need to take some individual actions. And so part of what maybe our conversation about individual action needs to sort of focus on that, the top, 10% who are actually contributing quite significantly to the climate crisis.
Absolutely. I mean, a small percentage of the population is driving this global problem. However, most of the U.S. falls into that 10%. Yeah. When you think about it globally, the United States is the 10%. It is our society. The United States is society, high consuming society that needs to change the most because we've created the problem. It's a huge equity issue that we need to lead on it.
Yeah, but it's also within countries. So what we're talking about is not only countries, but even within countries, what you start to do is narrow it down to the top 10% who are actually the larger emitters within the United States, because not everybody within the United States is emitting equally. So I think there are some ways to talk about individual, since, the government likes to talk about individual responsibility and what you can do as an individual. I think there are ways to talk about that actually target and focus our attention on the folks who are actually the top emitters in our own country, because they're significant. I think of Jeff Bezos or however you pronounce his name. I mean, his emissions are through the roof.
Right? Absolutely. But then from a strategy question, you know, is it possible to change Jeff Bezos's mind?
Well, that's not his mind.
Does he care?
Well, you talk about the government stepping in. So when we're talking about banning certain things, and that's government action. It's also pushing for government action. We need to be able to make the government needs to be able to make decisions around those top emitters as well.
Absolutely. Exactly. I think that's a good interplay of the two, right? If the government could set some sort of cap on emissions to make sure that people like Jeff Bezos or people with private jets aren't allowed to use those private jets without huge offsets, or maybe just straight out aren't allowed to. Maybe that's not where we're at as society, that they should be allowed to do that.
Right. Because at the gas station pump, what we have is that tax on gas, right? And then that affects everyday people in ways that are significantly different than it affects the top emitters. And so
totally, that's much more
really unequal. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You've talked in the past, I've heard you in these conversations and have been sharing some of these conversations with you, I've heard you talk about, well, some people say that ending capitalism is essential for climate transformation, or ending the two-party system is essential for climate transformation. I think fundamental to where XR strategy has come down to is the timeline is necessary to be very fast. 5 years, maximum 7 years, probably. And so the necessity of thinking about what can be done within this time frame is fundamental to that. You've talked about it better than I just did. Say a few words, please.
I think you actually said it very well. You know, let's take one of those examples, transforming from a two-party system, and talk about the steps that would actually be necessary to do that, right? Yeah. Like, you would need a viable third party. That's not going to start at a federal level. You'd need a viable third party to start winning elections at a state level. Maybe you could accomplish that in 10 years. Then they start expanding to other states. That's maybe going to take another 10 years. How long until the first third party federally elected, you know, the first third party candidate is elected at a federal level? I mean, we're definitely decades away from that. There's so many institutional reinforcements, funding, all these things working against that form of change. Capitalism's another step harder. I couldn't even start to spell out a roadmap for you of how we transform capitalism. Yeah. So we do, to some extent, if we're going to solve climate change, have to work within some of the systems that are in place for society.
And there have been activists in the United States who've been working for a 150-year project trying to change the two-party system and have not been successful thus far. Even if somebody thinks they have a novel strategy, like you said, it's going to take a lot more than 5 years to pull it off. I think it follows from what you say that someone who likes the two-party system can work with XR in the strategy outline that you've outlined. And someone who doesn't like the two-party system can work with XR with the strategy that you've outlined. Someone who actually likes capitalism for the most part and wants the economic system to be for the most part organized the same way can work with XR in the strategy you've outlined. And someone who hates capitalism and wants to transform it even on a revolutionary basis eventually, that person could also work with XR in the strategy framework that you've outlined.
Absolutely. I agree. We are not specifically saying what needs to happen in society outside of climate change. We are just saying this is what is needed on climate change.
We actually have a model of a group of folks who are pushing against and very successfully the two-party system, and they are actually actively turning it into a one-party system at the level of voting rights. The kinds of attacks you see across the country to sort of consolidate Republican power is extraordinary. And they have been doing this in ways that are extremely effective. And unless Democrats push back, we're going to see some real significant changes in terms of voting power. XR can't ignore that. And it seems to me that, we're talking about If we want to change things on some level in the government, it certainly can't be accomplished by a one-party system in terms of the party that's trying to hold on to power, even though they don't have the majority. So voting rights, I think it seems to me to be a central component of what XR can pay attention to, as well as nonviolent resistance. And part of that nonviolent resistance has to be about the consolidation of power that the Republicans are trying to get into place at this point.
Yeah, that's certainly a big issue. And I think there, like I said, 25% of federal officials deny climate change. Those are all Republican. So we could talk a lot about how bad the Republican Party is, but it's also important to hold that the Democrats are in power right now, controlling all three bodies of government, the House, the Senate, and the President.
Absolutely.
And they're not solving the problem. So neither of our two parties today is the solution. And that's not to say if we exert enough pressure through our strategy that one of those parties will not adapt and start to come around to an actual climate solution, but they're certainly not there today. There's no number of Democrats we could elect today to solve the climate crisis.
But for either Republicans, ahead, Elise.
Well, but the Democrats aren't actively seeking to disenfranchise a public that is for climate action. And so yes, indeed, the Democrats are in charge and they can certainly exercise more power they can be more powerful, but they're not disenfranchising people. And so the question is, if you're a part of the voting public that is actually for climate action is being disenfranchised, then it seems to me that that's a real problem that XR and other climate activists have to pay attention to and do some action around.
Totally. Voting rights. I guess we're talking a little bit past each other. I totally agree that voting rights is a very important issue. And I think separately am saying that the Democrats, are not taking action, that under 1% of the infrastructure bill that passed is going towards climate related infrastructure.
Right.
If I could try to put together what you've both said, there is a difference between Republican and Democratic parties on some issues that are important issues and that are climate relevant issues in the scheme of things. But in their current forms, neither Republican nor Democratic Party platforms and campaign approaches are remotely sufficient for addressing the climate crisis.
Exactly.
And so the necessity of shifting, as you call it, the Overton window, it requires working outside of either simple party structure. If I might venture a summary of your talk, I guess it would be that you can shift that Overton window, at least maybe possibly shift that Overton window with thoughtfully disruptive actions and thoughtfully artistic actions that get mass attention. And that can change the political conversation about what is possible to do on climate change. That's basically what we're shooting to do.
Absolutely. That's a really good summary.
So it does raise the following question. I think this next question would follow from that. I mean, it does raise the deeper concern that in our political structure, there's a capacity for decision makers to ignore mass movements. They can, and they sometimes do ignore mass movements. It's probably beyond the scope of what we're capable of resolving today. I don't know. I wouldn't be heavily involved with XR if I wasn't broadly on board with the strategy that you have outlined. I am broadly on board with the strategy that you've outlined. I think we should try it. We are trying it. But I'm deeply concerned about the fact that they're capable. They have done it before and they're capable of doing it again. Even if we massively increased beyond what we already were, Erika Chenoweth's research is often cited in these kinds of conversations where she points out that when there has been major transformative change, it's usually involved mobilizing a large segment of the population. And she comes up with the number 3.5%. But it doesn't follow from her work. People sometimes get this mixed up. It doesn't follow from her work that if you get 3.5%, you will automatically get mass change. I worry deeply about even if we were to pull off a mass nonviolent, mass attention getting movement, we wouldn't necessarily be, we wouldn't, because they're capable of ignoring that, it wouldn't get us toward our goal.
Yeah, well, I do think there's a lot of challenges in directly applying, for example, the 3.5% number from Chenoweth to our, to any climate strategy. Mm-hmm. The 3.5% number, a lot of the data points behind that, a lot of the movements behind that are regime movements, where what is being requested is a regime change. We want this president out and this president in. Mm-hmm. And that is an easy one-time change mm-hmm. to build enough momentum to create. You know, what has to happen for climate change is a substantive shift across multiple industries in how we use fossil fuels, or, you know, not using fossil fuels.
Right.
And that is not a thing that someone can commit to on one day. You know, that has to, that transformation has to play out over years. So I don't specifically prescribe to the 3.5%. But I would just say, you know, in general, what is effective and has been demonstrated in the UK, and I'll say my personal experience organizing, is it is possible to reach individuals and change their perspectives in the general public. That is what is most malleable. And if we are able to reach those people and change that narrative, it will become harder for politicians to hold positions that are not compatible with that. And I think a lot of people acknowledge that climate change is an issue. You know, there's good polling that says over 75% of people want more renewables, but how much do they really want renewables? There's good polling out of Yale's Climate Center that shows what people's attitudes are on climate change. And somewhere in the 20%, like 20 to 30% of Americans see climate change as an immediate issue. You know, many of them see it as like a broad issue or a general issue or a future issue, but a small percentage of people see it as a today issue. And that the difference between those two things is what we're trying to target when we talk to the general public.
In terms of talking to the general public, I get a little concerned about the spectacle aspect of XR. Not to say that it's not effective, because I think you laid out a really compelling argument about its effectiveness. But I worry about then the reliance on that to the extent that one doesn't go knocking on people's doors. Actually having conversations with people about climate change and about how it's affecting their everyday lives and what that means in terms of framing a strategy, right? So that, who gets to see the spectacle, or who sees the spectacle are the people who are mobilized, maybe, and where they're seeing that spectacle. So, you know, there are a lot of people who aren't on social media. There are a lot of people who aren't watching the media or paying attention to media where the spectacle is presented, or they're just, it's just part of their, how they're consuming the news or anything else on TV. So it's like, oh, that's interesting. How? Look at those red outfits that they're wearing. And so I worry about the, I worry about the lack of, you know, really door to door talking to people with XR.
I think that's a great point. That's another path that would be consistent with all of the points that we just outlined, right? You know, you can believe emergency action, government not taking action because of the Overton window, need to reach the general public, and you could say, let's go talk to people like one-on-one. That's another answer to that. And actually in XR Boston, we're starting a campaign called Emergency Everyone, which is around one-on-one conversations through a format called deep canvassing, which is essentially listening to people like you're talking about, and figuring out how to move them one-on-one a step towards understanding the emergency that we're in, and being more empathetic in that instead of just saying, it's an emergency, start to rebel, which a lot of people are not emotionally like at that point yet. So, no, I think that's a good point. That's another path that's consistent with our strategy.
I love deep canvassing. We should probably do a show or even two on on that method. Basically, you talk to people not for just a minute, for a while, and you listen to them too. You don't just talk at them. You actually have a conversation. And it's funny how little we do that in our society with people who we're not already connected to, but guess what? It really has an impact.
Sure does.
Totally.
So if someone is listening to this and they have not yet been much involved with Extinction Rebellion, but they like what they hear, how do they get involved?
That is a good question. Well, we are, like you said in the opener, an international movement with over 1,000 chapters globally. And so, you know, the first step is probably to find the chapter that's closest to you or that you're able to connect to, and join an orientation session. Each chapter runs their own orientation sessions that teach you a little bit more about their specific chapter and where what campaigns they're running and how you can support their chapter. But typically, you know, you can get involved planning the art and being an artistic person. You can work in outreach. I'm in our outreach working group. And so that's doing flyering one-on-one conversations, giving talks about climate change. You can join our action planning organization that puts together the logistics behind action. And those are some of the core pieces. Oh, and the media team, which writes our press releases, manages our social media. And then some chapters will have additional types of groups you can join. But those are the main core elements that are pretty consistent chapter to chapter.
And people can come to protest actions even if they're not heavily involved in one of those groups.
Absolutely.
Can be somebody who shows up.
Check out the calendar for your local chapter and they've got posts for, you know, their upcoming events and actions.
And how do you find your local chapter?
That's a great question. You can just go to extinctionrebellion.org and there's a map that has all of the pins for different chapters.
So extinctionrebellion.org, it would be the main entry point for like general people in the world.
Yep.
Alan, thank you very much for joining us today. This has been a great conversation.
Yeah, thank you both for having me.
This has been Extinction Rebellion Radio.
Filling our last 30 seconds here with an event announcement. XRNYC has a Subway Talks workshop on Saturday, March 5th from 2 to 4 p.m. in the Barnes & Noble Cafe in Union Square. The address is 33 East 17th Street. A Subway Talk is a two-minute personalized speech about the need to take action on the climate emergency that you could do on a train. Again, the info, the Barnes & Noble at 33 East 17th Street on Saturday, March 4th.
Tune to Out FM tonight, Tuesday, March 1st, for an interview with Professor Marhoefer about her book, Sex and the Weimar Republic, German Homosexual Emancipation and the Rise of the Nazis. She recounts the rise of Hitler's friend, Ernst Röhm, to power.
He went to bars and baths and had affairs with people, and all the while he was serving as a Nazi Party Reichstag delegate, and he kept his gay life completely secret from the Nazi Party.
Marhoefer also discusses his fall.
He's the guy who got killed in what's called the Night of the Long Knives. So after the Nazis came to power in 1934, they purged the Nazi Party, and he was one of the main targets.
Join us Tuesday, March 1st at 8 p.m. for a look back at the sexual politics of the pre-Nazi era during the period known as the Weimar Republic.
This is the mic check for Cat Radio Cafe.
Testing.
Testing.
Tune into Cat Radio Cafe Tuesday night at 9 here on WBAI.
I'm Janet Coleman.
I'm David Dozer.
The Displaced Playwright. On Tuesday, March 1st at 9 p.m., we'll be joined by Spider-Woman Theater's Muriel Miguel and Hinu Josephine Tarrant to discuss the world premiere of Misdemeanor Dream, the latest large-scale production of Spider-Woman Theater, the legendary downtown Brooklyn-based, feminist, indigenous, multi-generational theater ensemble.
That's Tuesday night at 9 here on WBAI.
Cat Radio Cafe.
Hey, do cats drink coffee?
Oh, come on, you know, if it's brewed with fish.
Sounds delicious.
Mm.
David Kenny of Everything Old is New Again every Sunday night at 10. Please join me then and please support WBAI at our brand new old number, which is 212-209-2950. Again, that's 212-209-2950. Hey, it's our old number, but it's new again. Because everything old is new again. I like it.
Activist Sharon Salam speaks out for WBAI.
We should be moving forward, collecting the funds that we need to make sure that our station is whole and that it can do its job as it has done for me in the past. When all of this stuff happened to me many, many years ago in 1989, I didn't get